Welcome to Dark Corners with David Allan Voiles. Dark Corners is brought to you by Gestalt Media, an independent publishing company dedicated to serving independent artists. Dark Corners is a horror podcast and may not be suitable for all listeners. Therefore, discretion is advised. Season 2 consists of episodes written and narrated by David Allan Voiles, based on a story suggested by the Halloween-themed musical work Witch Works, created by dark ambient musician Mombi Uhlman. The 13th episode concludes the season in October of 2020. Chapter 11. No Ordinary Hayride. Yeah, love you too. Daniel put his cell phone back in his pocket and took a sip from his spiced pumpkin ale. Laura looked at him expectantly from across their checkered tablecloth at the Loose Moose Brewery, where they enjoyed being seated outside. The tiny orange lights hanging in the trees glowed in the waning twilight. A light breeze offered just enough chill to make the evening seasonably cool without being uncomfortable. Deidre sends her love. They all seem extremely happy in their new home in Cary. Warren's ecstatic about getting hired by Cisco, and the girls seem like they're settling in without any new episodes of Night Frights or Chats with Rose. That's great. She's still okay with you handling the rest of the legal stuff? She says she is, which is unlike her, but I guess she just really wanted to get out of Dodge at any cost and be done with all this crazy stuff. I don't blame her, Laura said. I wonder if she took the girls' toys with them. I don't know. I didn't ask. Probably best just to start a new collection. Laura nodded and set her glass down. So tell me more about these new thoughts you've had about the O'Bannon estate. You're actually thinking of keeping it? After everything we went through? I can't imagine Deidre being okay with that. You gotta admit, it's a pretty awesome house. I think it's creepy as hell, Laura said. And you did too 2 weeks ago. I really don't understand how you can do an about-face like this. Daniel shrugged. It's not that bad. Not that bad? A couple at the nearest table turned to look at them, and Laura made an embarrassed face and mouthed sorry at them. With her voice lowered, she continued, "That house is as haunted as it gets." "But don't they say ghost can't hurt you?" "I've never said that," Laura countered. "The ones I saw were pretty damn threatening. You came out of one room with blood on your hands, for Christ's sake. And who knows what would have happened if we hadn't slammed the door before O'Bannon, or whoever, walked through the portal." "A portal? That's what that was?" Laura shrugged. "Seemed like one to me." "Well, the point is," Daniel continued, "he didn't come through. And nothing actually hurt us. We don't really know that what was on my hands was blood, since we didn't have it tested or anything. Could have been some kind of phantom goo. Ectoplasm, they call it, right?" Laura just narrowed her eyes. "What?" he asked. "I just don't get the big change in you. You were as terrified as I was that night. What's different now?" "Well, when I went back..."
"You went back?"
The couple turned again to look, and Laura gestured another apology.
"You went back?"
"Yeah, I went back. A couple of times now." Laura's eyes widened in disbelief. "And nothing happened in any of those visits."
"You went upstairs?"
"Yeah, just ordinary rooms."
"Even that one?
At the end of the hall?"
"Yeah, just another room. Nothing that special."
Laura stared at him. "I cannot believe you opened that door. After what we saw. Aren't you afraid you're letting him through? If he's coming for anyone, he's coming for you."
"It just seemed safe to me.
Somehow, in broad daylight, it didn't seem so bad."
"It was daylight when we started out over there."
"But then, any sense of time shot out the window," Laura said. "What can I say?
Daniel asked her. It just seemed like the right thing to do. And nothing happened. Actually, I feel more comfortable there than at the farm. Laura blew out her breath and shook her head. It's your decision, obviously, but I'm not sure I can go back in there. It was Daniel's turn to study her silently. He raised his glass, drained what was left, and said, Let's just forget about all this for a while and take in the festival. This is my favorite time of year, and the festival is the perfect kickoff to the season. Come on. He threw a few bills on the table for their server and took Laura's hand as they walked down the sidewalk past store windows decorated with paper skeletons, witches, and scarecrows. It was only a few blocks to the park where civic groups and school clubs had set up rows of booths and tables filled with handmade crafts and baked goods. The crack of BB guns at a shooting gallery mingled with the carnival music that was piped through large speakers situated around the park. The band boosters for the Maria Bay High School Marching Pirates had set up a ring toss event, with pop bottles placed into crates set at an angle for the chance to win dollar store items and stuffed animals that had been donated to the group as prizes. Laura stopped Daniel and pointed to a shelf in the middle of the wide assortment of fluffy kittens, pastel dinosaurs, and troll dolls. Clustered together were a small teddy bear, a ballerina, and two grinning clowns. Guess that answers the question of what Deirdre did with the girls' toys, Daniel said, at least some of them. I'd have gotten rid of all of them, Laura said, and gave herself a little shake as she remembered their night at the Brinson's house. Want a chance to win a prize for your lady, mister? Just a buck for three tosses. The large woman in an orange sweatshirt with a cartoonish black cat on the front held out a set of rings to Daniel. Oh, she's the talent in this duo, Daniel said, nodding his head toward Laura. We'll pass, thanks, Laura said, hooking her arm in Daniel's and pulling him along as she smiled at the woman. How about some dessert, Laura said as she moved them along toward a group of long tables set end to end, covered with homemade baked treats. Ooh, candy apples, I love those. She slid free from Daniel and stepped quickly toward the tables. She grabbed the popsicle stick handle on one, and called to the bespectacled man working closest to them. He'll pay for this when he picks out his treat, okay? But I'm going to go ahead and dig in. The man nodded and smiled, and Daniel grinned too, and began his inspection of the many goods offered as he walked down the display. A table of preserved fruits and vegetables caught his eye, and he stopped. We've got some pretty good produce this year, said the volunteer worker as he copied Daniel's slow walk on the other side of the tables. The man pushed his wire-rimmed glasses back up his nose and ran his fingers over the thin strands of a sad comb-over that tried in vain to hide his age-spotted bald head. Doris Johnson's apple butter just can't be beat. And Flora Mendoza's chili is blue-ribbon stuff. Daniel smiled at him and continued his slow inspection. He stopped where dozens of jars of peaches, pickles, apples, beans, and sauces sat in groups of like kinds. The attendant picked out a jar from the mix when he saw Daniel's interest in one particular group. I may be a bit partial, but I've got to say that my wife makes the best spaghetti sauce this side of the Atlantic. I do love a good sauce, Daniel said, and made a polite show of turning the jar around to inspect it. In the mix of tomatoes, green peppers, and ground beef, an eyeball looked back at him. The nightmare he had of his father with the horrors in the jars of his basement flooded back, and he dropped the jar just as he had in the dream. It smashed on the sidewalk, making a Rorschach splash of vegetables, sauce, and broken glass. I'm so sorry, he said to the attendant. I thought I saw... he broke off and shook his head rather than attempting to explain. I'll pay for this, of course. Yeah, okay, the man said, no longer smiling as he rummaged under the table for a roll of paper towels and a plastic trash bag. Daniel watched intently as the man scooped up the spaghetti sauce, expecting the fellow to be as horrified as he had been when he saw the eye. But when the last of the goopy mess had been cleaned up with no awful discoveries, Daniel wondered whether the eye had been there at all. Ew, gross! Daniel turned to see Laura hurrying to a trash can where she spit out the piece of candy apple she had bitten into.
He stepped quickly over to her as she wiped her mouth.
Look, she said as she held the apple out to him. It's rotten.
Before she could throw it into the trash, Daniel took it from her and said, Wait, the others might be rotten too. We should let the guy working the tables know.
The attendant gaped at the apple Daniel held out. There was no denying the decay just under the glossy red shell.
I think there might be a problem with these apples, Daniel said.
I've never seen that happen before, the man said. He seemed genuinely horrified about what Laura had discovered.
Usually you can tell a bad apple before you dip them in the syrup.
A chill coursed through Daniel at the mention of bad apple, and Laura took Daniel's hand.
What do I owe you for the spaghetti sauce? Daniel asked the attendant.
The man waved his hands and said, Let's just call it even. I'll get rid of these other apples before they cause any more problems for us. I'd hate to have somebody get sick because of one, or have the city shut down our fundraiser.
Daniel put his wallet away and saw that Laura was eyeing the fortune teller's booth across the way.
Thinking of having your fortune told? He asked.
My wife tells me Sheila Taglioni is a real psychic, the volunteer said. She says Sheila is pretty accurate with her tarot cards.
No kidding, Laura said. She looked at Daniel. Might be fun. Want to give it a try?
You're not saying you believe in that stuff, are you? Daniel asked.
I'm sure most of it's fake, but I also think it's possible some people may have certain skills in that area. Either way, it seems like harmless fun. Let's give it a try.
Daniel smiled, and hand in hand they crossed the park to where a hand-painted fortune-telling sign, clearly marked with the familiar image of a single eye, stood beside a blue tent that glowed from what appeared to be flickering lamps. A dark-haired woman sat in a folding chair at the entrance to the tent, reading a paperback copy of Blackthorne's Botanical Magic. She wore a thin black shawl with long fringe over a print blouse decorated with autumn-colored leaves and a long beige broom skirt over calf-high black boots. The raven feathers that dangled from her earrings were almost lost in her own long dark locks. She looked up as Daniel and Laura approached.
We hear you do great readings, Daniel said, stopping before her.
The woman stood and set her book in the seat of her chair.
Yes, would you both?
The smile on the woman's face faded as she looked at them and stopped speaking mid-sentence. Even in the dim evening light, Daniel and Laura could see that her face had paled. Her eyes darted back and forth as she looked from Daniel to Laura, and she swayed slightly.
Is something wrong? Are you okay? Laura asked, and reached out to grip the woman's elbow to steady her.
The woman sank back down in the chair, not caring that she sat on her book.
I think I stood up too quickly, she said.
She looked briefly up at Laura and then shifted her weight in the chair in order to pull the book out from under her. Avoiding eye contact with either of the customers before her, she said,
I'm sorry, I guess I'm not feeling too well. I'm afraid I won't be able to do any more readings after all.
Was there anything we can get you? Laura asked. Some water? Maybe something to eat?
It could be your blood sugar.
The woman waved her hand dismissively and continued to look down at her lap.
No, thank you. I'll be fine.
She glanced at Laura and gave a weak smile, which faded almost immediately.
I just need to gather my things and pack up.
She stood up and gave one final quick look at Daniel and Laura and retreated into her tent, pulling the entrance flap closed behind her.
Laura looked at Daniel and said, And the weirdness continues.
Yeah, so far our luck hadn't been too great, but I'm not ready to throw in the towel yet. The shooting gallery's always fun, and I'm pretty sure I can win you a prize.
If you must, Laura said, but no dolls or stuffed animals for me, thank you very much.
They followed the sound of the BB guns to a temporary gallery set up with shelves of tacky prizes that lined the plywood walls. Bales of hay were stacked behind a variety of targets. The front row consisted of small metal cutouts of iconic Halloween monsters sitting on a long makeshift table over which a black cloth had been thrown. Frankenstein's creature, a mummy, a werewolf, and an assortment of vampires and aliens were designed to fall back when struck by a BB. Above and behind them, a continually moving belt rolled to create a never-ending row of metal cutouts of ducks, which swam from left to right in a single line behind a thin cardboard facade of a pond, implying the marshy shore of a lake. The duck shapes were fastened onto the belt so that they, too, would lie down when struck. Behind them, balloons of various sizes and colors were pinned to the hay bales. A skinny fellow with thin, wispy hair and a gray stubble sat on a stool and leaned back against a support post. He pulled a pack of unfiltered Camels from the pocket of the unbuttoned blue and black checkered flannel shirt he wore over a Lynyrd Skynyrd t-shirt and shook loose a cigarette even though the stub of one still hung from his thin lips. He lit the new cigarette from the old one and pushed away from the post as Daniel and Laura approached. 5 shots for $2, he said, without taking the cigarette from his mouth. He picked up an air rifle that lay on the long counter separating him from the customers as he stomped out the smoldering butt and the dirt at his feet and handed the gun to Daniel. He removed the cigarette before he spoke again and took the 2 bills Daniel handed him, which he thrust into the pocket of his faded jeans. Each figure on the first row is 10 points. Ducks are 20 points apiece. The point value of each balloon is revealed when you pop it. Prizes are marked with the points needed to win. He sat back down on his stool and took a long draw from the cigarette as he eyed Laura appreciatively. "Well, what you want, babe? Dead-Eye Daniel will get you your heart's desire." Laura smiled, glad that Daniel had put the unsettling business with the snacks and the fortune teller behind him. She made a show of eyeing all the valuable prizes before finally saying, "I'm really liking that Felix the Cat clock." "With the moving tail and eyes?" Daniel asked. "Good choice. I knew you were a classy lady. So, how much is it?" 100 points, said the attendant as ashes cascaded down his chest. "Well, get ready to take that home," Daniel said. 5 little ducks and Felix is yours." He raised the BB gun and peered down the sight at the row of moving ducks. His first shot knocked a duck down. "Nice shooting, Tex," Laura said. He aimed again, pulled the trigger, and the BB struck the hay behind the ducks. "Damn, let him too much." "Gotta go for the balloons now, hotshot," Laura said. Daniel picked out a medium-sized blue balloon and fired. The balloon popped, revealing a white card pinned to the hay bale displaying the number 25 written with a black marker and then outlined in red. "Now we're talking," Daniel said. He pointed the rifle at a pink balloon slightly larger than the blue one and fired. It popped to reveal a point value of 10 points. "Hey, what the hell?" Daniel said to the attendant with his arms outstretched, the BB gun held vertically in one hand. The attendant just shrugged. "Okay, I'm guessing the smaller ones have the higher values. Last shot. Wish me luck." He picked out a small yellow balloon and fired. A crimson liquid spray splattered the hay behind where the balloon had been and dripped down onto the dirt floor of the booth. Daniel stared in astonishment and looked at Laura, who appeared equally dumbfounded. The attendant came over to Daniel and took the gun from his hand. "Only 15 points. Sorry, mister. That's the way it goes." "What?" Daniel asked. 15 points. Says so right there." He pointed at the red splash on the hay. "What's that red stuff?" The attendant looked confused without answering. "The blood or whatever. That the balloon was filled with?" "I don't know what you've been drinking, mister, but I'd like to get some." "You see it, don't you, Laura?" Laura looked from the hay bale to the attendant, who squinted at both of them as if preparing himself for an argument. "Yeah, but let's just go," she said quietly, once again pulling Daniel back towards the sidewalk that served as the main midway of the festival. "Well, what the hell was that all about?" Daniel asked. "Some kind of prank, I guess," Laura said. "Something to pull on the unsuspecting rubes." She attempted a light laugh that didn't seem that convincing. "Well, maybe it's time to call it a night." "Oh, no way," Daniel objected. "There's one more thing that's very definitely a Thompson tradition, at least for Deirdre and me. I wish she and her family were here to share it with us." "What's that?" Daniel paused for dramatic effect and lowered his voice. "The haunted hayride." "An actual hayride with horse and wagon and all that?" "Yeah. Well, They have a tractor instead of a horse, but yeah, a real hayride. We'll need to go back to the car and drive out to the Shepherd farm where they hold it.
I wouldn't want to be the one who breaks the tradition for you, Laura said. Let's go.
There was a modest crowd waiting for the next tractor to pull around and allow the excited horror lovers to climb onto the wagon where bales of hay served as benches along the sides. Daniel and Laura were grouped with three giggly middle school-aged girls and a family with three children ranging from 6 to 15 years old.
This is really good cider, Laura said as she took another sip.
It ought to be for what they charge for it. The man with wavy red hair had turned from his family to respond to Laura's comment. He looked down at his young son, whose fiery locks left no doubt about his connection to the man holding his hand.
Sorry, didn't mean to butt into your conversation. He offered his free hand to shake with Laura and Daniel.
John Brodsky. He gestured to the blonde woman who smiled at them. My wife, Jenny, and our daughters, Meg and Taylor. The two girls were oblivious to the introductions as they both were absorbed in whatever was streaming through their earbuds.
And this, he gently shook his son's hand, is Danny.
The boy did not smile and looked up briefly only to return his gaze back to the ground again.
Danny's not really sure about what to expect on this hayride, Jenny explained.
Oh, I get that, Daniel said.
Hey, Danny, my name's Daniel, too.
The boy looked up and then politely took Daniel's outstretched hand.
Always good to meet another Dan.
I remember my first time going on the haunted hayride. I was so scared all day long just thinking about it that my mother brought an extra pair of pants for me when we finally got here.
The young boy grinned.
Turns out, I didn't need them. They always have some pretty scary stuff, but it's way more fun than it is scary. In fact, I'll let you in on a little secret if you promise not to tell anybody.
Danny's eyes widened and he nodded. When I was in high school, I worked as a volunteer here. Sometimes I was made up to be a zombie or a monster, but you know what was the most fun?
Danny shook his head.
Being a plant on the wagon. They always put a worker on the wagon to act like they're a customer, and when some monsters attack the wagon, they pull that person off into the woods. It seems real, but it's all planned out. They taught us never to actually touch the guests, so you really don't have to worry about that.
Danny smiled, and it appeared that some of his tension had left. Jenny mouthed, "Thank you," and Daniel nodded and then leaned over and whispered to Danny, "See that guy all by himself?" He pointed at a young man wearing a green hoodie sweatshirt who had just walked up to join the group.
Danny nodded. "He's the plant, guaranteed. Bet you $10 he gets dragged off."
Danny grinned and bumped his fist to the one Daniel extended to him. The sound of a tractor approaching made them all turn. A man in a tan jacket, overalls, and a green John Deere cap pulled the wagon up to the area designated as the loading zone. A teenaged girl wearing vampire makeup that seemed incongruous with her UNCW sweatshirt and jeans unlatched the tailgate and dragged a set of wooden steps over for the guests to use to board the wagon. Laura waited for the trio of girls to climb in first, but the leader of the group motioned for her to go ahead and said, "We want to be near the back if you don't mind. That's where the action happens." The Brodsky girls looked at each other with big eyes. Their host assumed a pose to get their attention at the back of the wagon once they had all taken their seats.
"Please stay seated at all times,"
she said as she started her safety spiel, but her plastic vampire teeth slipped out of her mouth. With a single motion, she caught them and slid them back in almost without missing a beat.
"At all times, throughout the ride, and keep your arms and hands inside the wagon."
Laura punched Daniel to keep him from saying anything, and they shared a stifled giggle together. The middle school girls were not so kind. The Brodsky family sat directly opposite Daniel and Laura, with Danny snuggled securely between his parents. He seemed much happier now, armed with his insider information. The leader of the female gang of three sat beside Daniel, her group directly across from the Brodsky girls. The loner in the hoodie had lingered and was thus the last to be seated, and he chose to sit beside the older of the Brodsky girls, who appeared grateful not to be at the rear seat any longer. The vampire girl who had helped them load slid the steps away from the dirt road the tractors followed and secured the tailgate of the wagon. "Please remain seated until the ride is over. Do not exit the wagon until you are back here at the loading and disembarking station, where I will assist you. Have a great ride and good luck." The tractor started off with a jolt that made a few of the guests scream, and everyone gripped the arm or leg of the person beside them, whether they knew them or not. Within seconds, the wagon had pulled away from the reception area into the darkness. "Seems like Countess Dracula could use an appointment with an orthodontist," Daniel said to the Brodskys. Laura rolled her eyes but smiled, and the Brodskys chuckled. They passed oil lanterns hanging on posts at intervals, which Daniel remembered from his time working the event, were greatly appreciated by the actors, who often preferred to walk back to the parking lot at the end of their shifts. The headlights on the tractor provided plenty of light on the dirt trail directly before them. The areas off to the sides were just dark blurs. Their path took them across a corner of a pasture and into a wooded area that they would reach in just a few minutes. The middle school girls teased each other with their own private jokes and nervous anticipation, which caused them to burst into loud laughter every few seconds. Meg, the younger of the Brodsky girls, whispered something to her sister, who shrugged and then addressed the guy in the green hoodie. "So, do you do this kind of thing by yourself very often?" The young man who had been gazing out into the darkness behind them turned to look at her. He didn't smile or speak, but simply turned his gaze back to where he had been looking. "Okay, so that was weird," Taylor said. The middle school girls giggled again. "Looks like we're approaching our first scene," John Brodsky said. On the edge of the woods, they saw the shadowy outline of a small cabin, or at least the facade of a cabin, complete with rickety steps leading up to a covered porch. A lantern on either side of the screen door illuminated two emaciated figures, one in torn overalls and straw hat, and the other in a tattered gingham dress, that sat in rocking chairs with cobwebs hanging from the backs of their rockers to the front wall of the cabin. They looked as if they had died years before while sitting in those chairs, but as the wagon passed by, the chairs began to rock. The laughter from the wagon changed to squeals as the corpses rose from their chairs and stumbled down the steps toward the slowly moving wagon. The lantern light was just enough to allow the guests to catch glimpses of the stage blood that poured from the mouths of the dead farmer and his wife. Their shambling gait proved to be even slower than the tractor, which made its way at a snail's pace into the woods, and the couple were left behind. "Okay, this is fun," Laura said in Daniel's ear as she snuggled against him. Daniel knew she probably couldn't see his grin, but he finally felt like things were going as they should. She squeezed his hand and he squeezed back, and even in the pitch-black darkness they could see each other's smiles. The headlights showed the dirt road before them and nothing else. Even if there had been no staged scenes, the ride would have been spooky, Daniel thought. The first scene he remembered from his stint as a teenager, but he knew the group changed most of the scenes from year to year to keep the experience full of surprises. In the woods to the left, he spied more lantern light and figured that the wagon trail would be turning soon to take them closer to the source of the light. Sure enough, the tractor turned to the left. They could hear voices coming through the woods as they just began to make out moving shapes in the darkness.
"Hurry it up, Jake. We ain't got all night." "You come over here and take a turn then, dang it. I've been doing all the digging." "You know I got a heart condition. Now quit your jawing and get to digging. There's plenty of jewels in these coffins. And according to this letter," he waved a piece of paper in the air, "a bag of gold in one of them."
The two figures who had been arguing slowly came into view. They wore old, baggy clothes and were standing next to a large hole that had been dug in this small clearing in the woods. One of the actors leaned on a shovel while the other sipped from a flask. As the wagon pulled alongside the scene, it became evident that the guests were viewing a small graveyard. Old tombstones leaned at crazy angles over other holes, graves previously desecrated by Jake earlier. arms and legs began to appear on the edges of the graves, and people dressed in rags and made up to look like decaying corpses crawled out of the holes. Two of them attacked Jake and his partner, who screamed horribly as the corpses appeared to feed on their writhing bodies. Other zombies turned to the wagon and began to follow it. They moved faster than the dead farmer and his wife, so it was obvious that soon they would reach the party. The closer the zombies got, the louder the girls screamed, both the middle school group and the Brodsky girls. The first zombie that made it to the wagon grabbed the guy in the hoodie by the arm. Another zombie joined him, and although Hoodie Guy struggled valiantly, they were able to pull him from the wagon and onto the ground, where the others joined in to feast on him as he screamed. Daniel looked at young Danny in the dim light still afforded by the lantern of the scene, gave the boy a thumbs up, and nodded knowingly. Danny grinned and raised his own thumb in response. His sisters huddled together, as did the middle school trio, although much laughter mixed with their screams. Soon they were immersed in complete darkness again, except for the trail lit by the tractor headlights. It wasn't long until they came to a structure a bit more elaborate than the first scene, which had suggested only the facade of a farmhouse. It appeared to be an interior scene, a room in a house. Bookshelves lined three walls, the fourth wall being invisible, like the fourth wall of a live play through which the audience views a scene. Laura's grip on Daniel's arm tightened, and she felt him squeezing her other hand back. Dolls and toys were positioned as if they were climbing down from the shelves to join other toys that had already massed on a body which lay on the floor of the room. "Daniel, that's Harold O'Bannon's library," Laura said. "Yeah," Daniel answered. "My library now. This looks just like it. And that must be Sidney Johnson on the ground. This is in poor taste, don't you think? Even for Halloween. I mean, he died just like a month and a half ago." The tractor continued on its path while the guests braced themselves for something to happen. The fact that nothing did offered no respite from the tension. In fact, it did just the opposite. Everyone in the wagon, including the adults, held their breath as they pulled away from the murder scene and were swallowed by the darkness. After a few minutes of slow progress through the woods, the tractor came to a stop, and the headlights went out. Two torches on either side of their path illuminated an object that blocked their way, a simple structure erected in the middle of the path. "What is that?" John Brodsky asked. "Seems sacrilegious to me," Jenny said. "I don't think they should use religious symbols like that." Daniel knew exactly what it was because he had seen it, or something just like it, behind his barn about 2 months earlier. "It's a scarecrow stand," he said. What Jenny Brodsky had taken to be a religious crucifixion was actually a recreation of Stan Kobritz's death. The sharpened center pole of the stand ran through the body of what appeared to be a remarkably realistic dummy of a young man in bloodied clothing. Its arms were extended out to either side and bound to the crosspiece with vines. The flickering light from the torches made the figure seem as if it were twitching. "What the fuck is going on?" asked one of the middle school girls. Danny began to whimper and his father spoke up. "Hey, language, please. Listen, it's all part of the show, guys. Having a mechanical breakdown is a standard trick with these spook rides." Daniel saw the driver hop down from the tractor where he attempted to shine a pocket flashlight on the engine, but repeated clicks seemed to indicate that the flashlight would be of no help. The crackle of a walkie-talkie broke the silence that followed Daniel's comment, and the guests realized that the driver was trying to reach someone in charge. "HQ, this is Driver 1. Do you read me? Over."
"Driver 1, we read you. What's up? Over."
"I got a problem. The tractor engine just died on me. I can't get it to start back. I guess the battery's dead. I could use some assistance. Over."
"Roger that, Driver 1. We'll send someone out your way. Where are you? Over."
"Well, that's a bit of a problem. I'm not sure. Did you make some new scenes today? Over."
"Negative, Driver 1. All is as it's been for the last 2 nights. Why? Over."
I just come upon the second scene that wasn't here last night, and this one's blocking my path. Over. Silence. HQ, this is Driver 1. Do you read me? Over. Silence. As the driver turned the frequency knob on his walkie, the figure splayed out on the cross before them lifted its head. More than one person in the wagon squealed. The driver repeated his message again, but there was clearly tension in his voice. HQ, this is Driver 1. Do you read me? Over. Silence. The figure on the cross pulled its right hand free from the vines that held it onto the crosspiece and gripped the wooden plank. It did the same with the other hand, and then using its feet to push against the center pole, it slid itself up the pole, leaving a slick coating of blood and sticky matter on the pole as it did so. It managed to push itself up past the jagged spear point and drop to the ground, where it immediately then squirmed to right itself, then knelt on all fours before finally rising to a full standing position. The driver made his way over to whom he assumed was an actor playing the role of a victim of human sacrifice. Hey fella, nice act. We're dead in the water here. Tractor just cut off. You got a walkie on you? Mine seems to be. His words were cut off as the bloody actor reached out and gripped the driver's head with both hands. He jerked the head once violently to the side, and the driver slumped to the ground. The figure then gripped the driver by the shoulders of his jacket and began to pull him off into the woods. The guests were so focused on watching the gruesome scene before them, they failed to notice the approach of the figure coming to the wagon from the woods beside them. The girl who was closest to the tailgate screamed, and the others in the wagon turned to see a man in a torn uniform and Stetson hat dragging the girl over the side of the wagon and onto the ground. His face was gaunt and ghastly pale, almost as if no skin covered the skull at all. But the resemblance was enough with the uniform for Daniel to know that this was supposed to be Sheriff Kobritz. More figures, too dark in the shadows to be recognizable, moved in the woods on either side. "These people have taken this way too far," John Brodsky said. He stood on the hay bale where he had been sitting and vaulted over the side of the wagon onto the ground. "John, wait, come back," his wife called. He ignored her and ran around the back of the wagon, his mind set to free the screaming girl from what he believed was an overzealous actor. "Let her go, asshole," he yelled to the man who dragged the girl by one arm, as she stumbled while she tried desperately to keep her footing. When he caught up to the sheriff, Mr. Brodsky grabbed him by the back of the shirt and pulled, but the fabric ripped and fell away, revealing torn, rotten flesh. The sheriff turned and let go of the girl, who struggled to her feet, and then ran back to the wagon where the others had been watching the scene play out. Kobritz, or whatever it was that looked like Kobritz, grabbed Brodsky by the throat with one bony hand and forced the man to his knees. Brodsky gripped the sheriff's arm with both hands, but he could do no more than make gurgling noises as he choked, his eyes bulging as he stared into the skeletal face before him. "John!" Jenny Brodsky screamed. She stood in the wagon with her arms around her children, who huddled around her as they all watched helplessly. She turned to Daniel and Laura and cried, "You've got to help him! Please, help him!" "Daniel?" He looked to where Laura was pointing. Two clowns peeped around the trunks of the trees they were hiding behind, their wicked grins illuminated by the flickering torchlight. Daniel turned and looked on the other side of the trail, where two more faces also peered at them from the darkness. A man in a bear costume and a solid white mask with feminine features. "This is no act," Daniel said. "We've got to get out of here. Everyone out of the wagon. We're sitting ducks here. We've got to move." He pushed past the girls on both sides of the wagon, who were still paralyzed by their fear, to release the latches that allowed the tailgate to drop. He grabbed Laura's hand, and together they made the short jump to the ground. "We've got to help John," Jenny cried as she remained in the wagon hugging her children, who were all crying as well. The two middle school girls also huddled in the wagon rather than jumping down. Daniel looked to where the sheriff was still choking the man, and Kobritz turned his head toward the group. His thin lips stretched into a wide smile, making his visage even more skull-like than before. "You gotta run!" Daniel yelled as he pulled Laura away from the wagon, the two of them stepping backwards along the dirt road. "There's nothing we can do for him, Jenny. These things aren't actors. They aren't even human. You've got to run." "Daniel, we can't just leave them," Laura said. But even as she spoke, the sheriff released his grip on John's throat
and John's body fell back lifelessly onto the ground. The sheriff then started making his way to the wagon, and the figures in the woods, the clowns, the bear, a ballerina in a white mask, and other costumed characters, a pirate, a ghoul in a convict's striped suit, and a skeletal witch with a torn black dress and partially crushed hat, stepped slowly out of the shadows to join him. Glimmers of light from the two flaming torches flickered near them as they moved, revealing that they all held clubs or long, sharp blades. "Run, Jenny, you've got to run," Laura cried, turning back to yell over her shoulder as Daniel continued to pull her away from the scene. She yanked her hand free from Daniel's grip and stopped to yell again at the people left in the wagon. "Take the kids into the woods and hide. We'll try to get help and come back to find you." "Come on, Laura," Daniel urged. "We've got to move. There's more of those things in the woods." He took his phone from his pocket and turned on the flashlight feature and shined it on the trail where they had traveled just minutes before in the wagon. Laura turned and he saw her face was wet with tears.
"They're not leaving, Daniel."
"There's nothing we can do. Maybe they won't get hurt if they don't seem to be a threat," Daniel said, but he knew his words sounded hollow. He took Laura's hand again and started running swiftly back the way they had come. Shapes moved in the darkness beside them as they ran. When Daniel flicked his light to the side, Laura cried, "Don't! They don't seem to be bothering us as long as we don't act like we know they're there." He returned the light to the road before them, but the glimpse he had was disturbing. They, too, seemed to be wearing masks, for his mind had vague suggestions of animal faces, a bull's head with horns, and a boar. The crying in the distance from the wagon suddenly turned to screams. Laura stopped and turned back, but Daniel said, "The best thing we can do is to get help." He pulled her hand gently and she allowed herself to be led again, and they trudged on. It was only a minute or two before they saw the lights from the scene they had viewed just before they came upon the scarecrow stand, the Sidney Johnson murder scene. "Oh God," Laura said, "I really don't want to look at this again." "Don't," Daniel said, "just keep your eyes on the road." But Daniel found that hard to do himself. The library was done so realistically that he found himself wondering how they knew the details of the room, the layout, the placement of Sidney's desk, the fireplace. The idea of toys and stuffed animals climbing from the shelves to attack Sidney was a horrifically creative touch. But Daniel had never heard just what the cause of death was ruled to be. Reports had just said he died of natural causes. A heart attack, he had assumed. A noise caught Daniel's attention. A chattering noise and thin, high laughter. He couldn't stop himself from looking at the scene. When Laura saw that he had been distracted, she glanced over too, although they both kept their steady, brisk pace on the road. The little figures on the shelf were moving, climbing down onto the ground. They looked up at Daniel and Laura and grinned. The ones on and around Sidney's body looked up at them too, and they began to move toward the road. "Run!" Daniel yelled, and they ran quickly away from the scene, on down the road to safety. They ran until finally Daniel stopped. He let go of Laura's hand and said, "Got to catch my breath. Go on. I'll catch up." He leaned over and clutched his knees as he gasped for breath. Laura came to a stop and listened. Daniel handed her the phone light, which she shined on the trees around them. "I don't hear or see anything," she said. He nodded, still winded from their run, while Laura waited and watched. "It can't be too much further to the pasture," she said, as Daniel finally straightened and was once again breathing through his nose. "Let's go," he said. They walked for another minute in silence until they came to a mist that moved on the dirt trail before them. It swirled, although there was no breeze, and gradually it coalesced into a recognizable shape, the form of a man. A bearded man they recognized.
"Greetings, my loves. Fancy meeting you here."
He wore the same dark clothing they had seen when they had kept him from entering through the doorway on the second floor of the mansion, and yet his form was semi-transparent.
"I really must thank you, Daniel. You provided me with the nourishment I needed to make this appearance. And yet, I still need one more sacrifice."
Laura gasped as both of her arms were seized and pulled behind her. Daniel turned to see that her assailant was his father, looking as deathly pale as he had when he saw him in the vision at the mansion. He moved to help her, but O'Bannon raised one hand and made an odd gesture, and Daniel found himself frozen. Frank bound Laura's wrists together with strong tape and gripped a handful of her hair to keep her head held high.
"Thank you indeed, Daniel. You've been most helpful. Only a few more steps, laddie, and all will be done."
Frank Thompson pulled Laura's head back, exposing her throat. With his free hand, he brandished a long knife with strange ornate symbols carved into the handle and ran its long blade across Laura's throat, releasing a river of blood that ran down her body. That concludes this episode of Dark Corners with David Allan Boyles. Music for Dark Corners was written and performed by Mombi Yuleman and can be purchased at mombiyuleman.bandcamp.com. For my latest projects, you can always find information at my official website, davidallanboyles.com. And I invite all of you to join our Dark Corners Facebook group, where you can find background information on posted stories, previews of upcoming stories, and all kinds of other dark content. Hope we meet again soon in the Dark Corners.